Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the premiere edition of the Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA, and we're really happy to be here. First, we're going to take a look at the 2008 presidential election with Sherrilyn Ifill and Anthony McCarthy, Senator Obama, Senator McCain, and what will Hillary Clinton supporters do? And then we talk with the creator of The Wire, David Simon. The Wire's off the air, but he has new projects in New Orleans and other places. We'll talk about those. Then we talk with Ta-Nehisi Coates and Paul Coates. Ta-Nehisi wrote the book, The Beautiful Struggle, His Road to Manhood Here on the Streets of Baltimore. So for all this and more, join me this hour for The Mark Steiner Show, right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, Voice of the Community, right after this NPR news break. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This is the premiere edition of the Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA. We're really very happy to be here, and we're looking forward to this summer coming to you once a week, and so in the fall coming to you every day. And in this first part of the Mark Steiner Show, let me say that we have a couple of interesting guests to talk about the presidential election. Anthony McCarthy joins us in studio. He's a former editor-in-chief for the Baltimore Afro-American, hosted his own show here on WEA for some time called Daybreak, as well as the News Roundup on WYPR. And Sherrilyn Ifill, a noted professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, a major civil rights attorney, author of The Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and has just been nominated for the Hurston Wright Award, one of the major book awards in the United States. And Sherrilyn, congratulations on that. And Sherrilyn, Anthony, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
It is great to be here and great to hear your voice on the radio again, Mark.
It's good to be back.
What an honor to be here with you on this very special day for WEAA, Mark.
And for me, I'm really happy to be here, and I want you all to join us there. Your thoughts in this first part of our program about the presidential election at 410-319-8888, and we'll take your calls. We want to hear what you have to say about Obama and Mr. McCain, and whether or not Hillary Clinton supporters will come over, and what has to happen in this election. And a couple of kind of questions here, and I wonder if this election, A, we know it's going to be about issues on some level, on many deep levels, but it seems to me there's politics here that could decide a lot of this election, and the politics of the people who have yet to make up their minds. Who in America is torn between McCain and Obama, and why? And how much of that is race, and how much of that are real issues, and how much of that is people who don't really delve into issues so much as get a visceral attachment about hope and fear of the future. Sherrilyn?
Well, I think there's never been, at least in the last, I'm going to say 20 years that I can, you know, since I've kind of consciously been paying close attention to these elections, I don't think there's been a bigger slice of voters that could be characterized as swing voters as there are in this election, because I think there's such a tremendous amount of disaffection with President Bush among Republicans that I think a lot of Republicans are looking for options. And Republicans who would otherwise have supported McCain, who was for a long time kind of the maverick independent of the party, but who was tacked so hard to the right towards President Bush's policies for reasons that we could maybe talk about later, that a number of people just, you know, don't feel that he's going to be significantly different than George W. Bush. And, you know, all of the talk shows like to say the Republican brand has been damaged. I think that's very true. At the same time, I think that there are Democratic voters who, traditionally Democratic voters, who, in part for reasons of race, are inclined to hesitate to vote for Obama and who therefore are willing to embrace the old idea of McCain as the maverick, even though there's no evidence. And in fact, really all of the evidence suggests over the last two or three years that he has really given up that role to walk lockstep with the policies of the Bush administration. But I think there are Democratic voters who, because they do not want to vote for McCain, or, I mean, Obama, or feel uncomfortable voting for Obama because of his race, will try and embrace McCain as the maverick he used to be, as the change candidate, and use that as a reason to cross over and vote Republican.
Mark, I think that McCain has made it very clear that this is at least the first part of this campaign is going to be directed at shoring up his base, making sure that conservatives are getting more and more comfortable. And it doesn't seem to be working, by the way. But he's also talking to those Reagan Democrats that he would love to see fall back into that category. They're the people who went against John Kerry, even though John Kerry came very close, stuck with George Bush, George W. Bush. He needs those Reagan Democrats to be very, very uncomfortable with Obama. That's why they're talking about Jimmy Carter. That's why they're talking about the most liberal senator ever to be nominated by the Democratic Party. And then there's this swath of independent voters who have been really attracted to Barack Obama, but also attracted, as Sherrilyn said, to the independent, straight talk express John McCain. But we don't see that McCain, at least not in the first initial part of this campaign.
I can't tell how many people have said to me about this election, about Senator John McCain, over and over again. A, he's not really a conservative. And B, I love his maverick, being a maverick and independent. And C, I don't like, added to that is how Hillary Clinton was treated during the primary by the press. And that's a volatile mix. And if you also take a statistic I heard the other day, which really was fascinating to me, which was 10% of all Americans would consider themselves like out and out racists. 20% of people who voted Democratic who are over the age of 44 are opposed to interracial marriages, don't like the idea, can't stand the idea of interracial marriages. But when you get to people under 44, it's down to 3%. But those statistics together, if you marry them in some odd way, showed me a kind of volatility for what could happen in November.
Well, Mark, it's a potentially very dangerous volatile mix for Barack Obama if you continue to believe that older people are going to control the outcome of this election. If this election is, as I increasingly think it is, about a new generation of voters who, as you suggest, are not bound by some of the more traditional views on race, and by the way, there are many African Americans who also would be opposed to interracial marriage, so I'm not sure how much that statistic really tells us about who people are likely to vote for. But if this is about young people, then it's a whole different set of ideas and ideals that young people are bringing to this race in terms of what they think politics is and what they think the presidential election means. And if they continue, young people, to turn out in the numbers that they've been turning out in, for example, in the Democratic primary, then I think that they are much more in play than we're traditionally used to thinking of in terms of young people voting. So I think we just have to be careful when we look at those statistics to not assume that the same age demographic is going to be the demographic that controls the outcome of this election.
I think not only young people, but I think millions of new voters have been added to the Democratic Party base over the life of this very tumultuous primary season. I mean, millions of new voters, not just young people, but people who kind of walked away from the Democratic Party, which they saw the parties melding into one party, and they were very disenfranchised. They were very disheartened by what they saw in the leadership of the Democratic Party, now very excited about the potential of electing a historic president. And I think we need to watch those numbers because even independents in New Hampshire and other places who were just really down on the Democratic Party, re-engaged in the Democratic Party, looking forward to becoming part of this new generation, not by age, but by this new generation voter who's going to change Washington. And I think it's interesting, Barack Obama talks about change a lot. I have not heard the word change as much as I have from John McCain in the last 48 hours. He is talking constantly about that culture. He's trying to really pull those people who may not be as informed as voters, but really do know one thing about John McCain, that he has bucked the Republican Party and they're attracted to that. And he's trying to hold on to them while really trying to appeal to the conservatives, the evangelicals, and that base that he's going to need to win. I'm not sure if he has that formula down yet.
Let's open the phones here, folks. Join us here on the new Mark Steiner Show as we look at the presidential campaign with Anthony McCarthy and Sherrilyn Ifill here on WEAA. Our number is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. And we'll take your calls here as we look at this election. And Sheldon in Pikesville, you're on the air. Oh, let me push the button myself. That's right. different format here. Here we go. Go.
Thank you for being back on the air. We certainly missed you.
And
I'd like to thank WEAA for bringing the Mark Steiner Show back to the air. I have a comment to make about the angry Clinton voter and what the angry Clinton voter is likely to do in the fall. Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead. We're listening to you.
I wasn't sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sean. We got you.
Yeah, I was getting silence on the line.
No, we're here.
We're listening.
Just listening.
It develops that Clinton outpolled Obama among women by only 9%. And I think it's very reasonable to project that Obama will capture at least half of that vote in the fall. If he did, it would mean that he would have at least 50% of the primary vote that was cast in the just concluded primary season. I think he's likely to do better. Often the fanatic Clinton supporters portray her 18 million votes as if they were cast by zombies who will only do, you know, whatever Senator Clinton tells them to do. I think the reality is that most of those voters, most of Clinton voters who voted for her, would comfortably have voted for Obama if Clinton had not been on the ballot. And now she's not on the ballot. So I think that the angry Clinton female voter has been greatly overemphasized. I have a feeling it's not likely to be a significant factor in the fall.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I think it's very interesting. I think Sheldon hits on something. When you look at the so-called committed Clinton voters who are going to jump for McCain, I was over at the Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting, and a lot of the angry women, they started shouting McCain's name once the Bylaws Committee made their decision about Michigan and Florida. But it's very telling when you start talking about issues, when you start talking about the Supreme Court, when you start talking about advances that people have made, I do not believe that these women are going to jump in the numbers that people have been talking about. And when you talk about fanatical Clinton voters, you have to remember Barack Obama also has fanatical supporters in this country who are sticking with him. I read an incredible article that you turned me on to, Mark, by Sherilyn Eiffel, about feminism and the Clinton voters. And I think it's very telling if they stick with issues, if they talk about issues. And I think those voters are going to come back into the Democratic column in large numbers. We won't even see that 8-9% split that Sheldon was talking about. I think in large numbers, women are going to help elect Barack Obama.
Sherilyn?
Well, let me also say, since Anthony very nicely plugged my article, that, you know, I wrote this article about the Clinton campaign and why I don't think her defeat really says anything about feminism, because I don't think she ran a feminist campaign. I have gotten more responses to this op-ed than anything I've ever written, and 97% of them have been from women who identify themselves as white women in their 50s or 60s. Who have wholeheartedly agreed with me, and who have, you know, one woman said, I was prepared to vote for a woman, whether she was Republican or Democrat, just because for my generation to have, you know, the idea of a woman being president was such an important milestone. But, you know, she said as Hillary Clinton's campaign went forward, she became more and more distressed and ultimately embarrassed by the way the campaign was being conducted. And so I do think there is also a group of women out there who are of that generation. I don't think Hillary Clinton owns that demographic in the way that the press has suggested that she does. I think there are many women who feel very strongly that that Hillary Clinton did not present the best face for a woman candidate to be running and during her campaign. They also, many women who talked about feminism said, you know, that they wouldn't support her just because of her gender, because that was at the heart of feminism, that, you know, that no one should get an advantage simply because of their gender. So I don't think she owns that demographic. I do also think you're right when you begin to, I heard a number of people over the last few days saying that, you know, the key two words that Barack Obama has to say over and over again is Supreme Court. And that if he keeps talking about what this will mean for the Supreme Court, that is something that will energize even so-called fanatical Clinton voters to recognize what a McCain presidency will mean to the things that they believe in for decades to come, because of the importance of the possibility of having two and possibly three nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so that for that particular demographic, if Barack Obama keeps hitting this is about the Supreme Court, that it's going to be very hard for those women, despite the very strongly felt views and feelings they have right now about how they believe Senator Clinton was treated in the campaign. It will be very hard for those women to pull a McCain lever in November.
Sherrilyn Ifill, Anthony McCarthy, join us here to talk about the presidential elections. Lines are open here, 410-319-8888. And Mike in Ellicott City, you're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. Mike, don't start talking. I got to hit your button there. You're on the air.
I heard you on the air before, haven't I, Mr. Stein?
I think you have, yes. But we're in a different and a better place now.
Pleasure. Let me tell you. That's not what I called about, but right. I just did want to say it. Thank you for coming back, and thank WEAA. I have some predictions about the election, because I think we're in a very difficult time. Prediction number one, and I know this sounds trivial, but please hear me out. Either John McCain or Barack Obama will be elected president. Now, no one's utterly shocked or fallen out of their chair yet. Here are some other predictions, and they're hard. We're going to have more homeless people. We will still have U.S. military in Iraq. We will have more people without health insurance. And the well-being of our population will decline. We need something new. Barack Obama's big advantage is his name is not John McCain, who promises he could stay in Iraq for a century. Well, I'm not John McCain either, and I don't expect you to vote for me for that reason. We need something new. I don't know how we're going to get it, but we better put our heads together and figure out something. I know the Supreme Court issue is serious and frightening. Our situation is serious and frightening. We need to figure out how we're going to get something better than what the Democrats and Republicans are giving us.
I think that he has hit on something. At the end of the day, the pulse of this country, we really have to put our ear to the ground and listen, and people are hurting. This is a change election, and John McCain's best defense of not going into a third Bush term is that he's going to do things differently. Certainly Barack Obama saying the same thing, but if it's about those bread and butter issues, about people keeping their homes, about being able to keep their children in school and send their children to college, about how much gas is costing you right now. I think that Americans are hurting, and they want something different, and they're looking to a different party that's in charge right now. Now, regardless of the fact that Democrats are in charge of Congress, they're looking for something, a stark, sharp turn from George W. Bush. His approval rating, Mark, I looked before I came over this morning, is less than 26%, his approval rating in this country.
It's the lowest since they started taking approval ratings.
And so the Republican brand is in trouble. John McCain can save that brand by doing something differently. I think the odds are against him, and I think that our caller just hit on several things. We're going to see people hurting, and people are going to want some relief.
You know, John McCain's problem, I think, and Anthony alluded to this already earlier, is that he's trying to do what is a very difficult and maybe impossible dance, unless you're super coordinated, and that is that he's trying to continue to hold on to the base, to the hard right George W. Bush base, while being the candidate of change. And, you know, that's the reason why he can't repudiate and doesn't repudiate the Bush policies. I mean, we just had the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, release the second part of their report, essentially concluding that President Bush and Vice President Cheney and so forth misled the public and misled the Congress in order to lead us into the Iraq War. Well, this is important news. I mean, because, you know, this is the Congress that John McCain was a part of. He has not repudiated President Bush on the Iraq War. You know, he's talked about staying in Iraq, you know, as long as necessary, if we have to stay 100 years. You know, he gave in on the torture issue in terms of the military commissions. There's so many levels on which it's hard for him, I think, if he's going to hold on to the base and continue to demonstrate that allegiance to George W. Bush, for him to also be the candidate of change. And you saw it with the endorsement of John Hagee, the minister that you know, made these incredible comments that you know, McCain was loath to let go of him because of what he represents for the evangelical base.
Well, I mean, the people on the other side of the aisle could also say the same thing about the reluctance for a long time with Obama let go of Reverend Wright and all the things that rolled around that. And Obama's been doing a lot of hedging and dancing. He started dancing on his Iran policy questions and whether he would negotiate directly or not. He's picked up John Furman to put in his campaign as an economic advisor, who said it's wonderful that wrote the book saying how wonderful it was that that Walmart gives low prices, so it's okay not to pay his workers a decent wage and give them health care. I mean, so he's got some issues that he's going to have to deal with in this election.
Most definitely. When you present yourself as the change candidate and squeaky clean, people are going to put you to the test. And not only his situation with his economic advisor, but this 50-state strategy he keeps talking about, Mark, and I'm sure I'll get to come on again and talk about this weird strategy. They've got to focus on these swing states. But anyway, that's the other thing. And I predict also he has gotten himself in this trouble by constantly hitting McCain on this lobbyist issue because McCain is supposed to be so clean. And then he chooses a very powerful lobbyist to hit his vice presidential search. And that's going, and already Republicans are hammering him on that every single day. He's going to end up letting Mr. Johnson go. And Caroline Kennedy is going to really step up to the plate and really lead this effort, because this gentleman who made a lot of money as a lobbyist, who was a CEO for Fannie Mae, really involved with Countrywide Financial, and we are in this mortgage crisis. So Barack Obama has to be careful. If you say that you're squeaky clean, and no one's squeaky clean, but if you say you're squeaky clean, you better practice what you preach. Or certainly Republicans are going to hold him to that standard.
Well, you're absolutely right, Anthony, because the reality is that in order to become president of the United States, to raise the kind of money that Barack Obama's been able to raise to engage in the really masterful campaign that he waged, you know, you can't be entirely an outsider. I mean, it's not as if he's just, you know, come from the streets and, you know, it's going to walk into the White House. It's just not, you know, our political system is just not that way. And so on one hand, he's talking hard about it. But the reality is, I mean, if you've heard some of his speeches, particularly on foreign policy, I mean, you know that it was Barack Obama who said he'd be willing to go in and make military strikes against Al-Qaeda strong posts in Pakistan without the consent of Pakistan.
That's
so
right.
He'd be willing to do that. He made that very clear. He talked about, you know, yes, last week when he was at AIPAC, doing everything in his power to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, and he repeated everything about five or six times to reassure that audience, everything. I mean, he meant to say everything is on the table. So Barack Obama is running as a change candidate, and that there's no question that his policies would be different than those of the current administration. But he's also not running as, you know, flowers in his hair and you know, spreading peace and love. Only, I think he's not running as a hard left candidate,
Well, though we could, there's a lot of critique I think could be given about Barack Obama and what he did at AIPAC as well. I thought he played to that crowd in the same way, in many ways, McCain did, just from a different angle. I wasn't really impressed by Barack Obama in front of AIPAC. But I wish we had more time for this. We're going to have you both back as we spend a great deal more time in the coming months looking at, our next guest is not here, so let's keep going. I was not really impressed at all by Barack Obama at AIPAC. I thought he played to that crowd, we'll let Jerusalem stay the capital, no discussion of it. I think he made some, I think he did not serve himself well there.
I think that he was, as Sherilyn said a few moments ago, I think Barack Obama was doing such a dance in front of that audience. The expectations were so high for him when he went before AIPAC. There have been so much written, so much on the internet about his relationship with Israel, his policies on Israel, that he really did need to reassure that audience. And I almost thought it was laughable, if I could be so disrespectful, I guess, how often he repeat his positions and how he loves Israel and how he will be a supporter of Israel. Now, the other thing is, as Sherilyn said also, you have to be very serious about the reality of this campaign. He is a change agent. He is a different type of politician than we've seen in Washington in a long time, but he is a politician and he is going to make these promises. But you know what? I think it'll be very interesting to see what he says before the Arab League and others about his policy when it comes to Hamas, about his policy when it comes to the Palestinian state and these other things, because he made a lot of promises before AIPAC that he's going to be held accountable for, not only by AIPAC, but by the other side as well.
We have an email here. A lot of them come in. You can also join us back to the phones here at 410-319-8888 as we look at the presidential election. 410-319-8888 with Anthony McCarthy and Cheryl Neifel here on the new Mark Steiner Show. Renee writes in, welcome back, Mark. As for Senator Obama, he seems to still have much energy left for the liking of most American people, regardless of the amount of energy he has brought to politics. Sure, he energizes young people, but will they heed head out to vote? They disappointed the Democrats in the last two presidential elections, remember? Now, I've been talking to a lot of young people on campuses. They seem energized and excited about this election, but the question is, will they really come out? And let's hear what one of our listeners has to say. Kevin in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. Welcome back. This is Kevin. Glad to have you on. Quick comment. You guys have made a lot of good points. I think this is Obama's race to lose. If you look at the electoral map, he's got it wrapped up. The thing that really puts it on the top, though, is money. Obama's going to raise $100 million this month, they're saying. McCain can only spend $85 million for the whole campaign. Obama's team is saying they're going to raise $600 million, so it's going to be a 6-to-1 advantage. Combine that with the Republican name being in bad shape and the excited young voters and the electoral map, Obama has this race. It's his to lose.
Well, you know, Barack Obama spent an enormous amount of money in West Virginia, and that's a whole different demographic that you really have to parse. But he spent an enormous amount of money in West Virginia. He spent an enormous amount of money in Ohio. He spent an enormous amount of money in Pennsylvania, and Hillary Clinton still trounced him in those states. I think that money is important, and the fact that Barack Obama has broken every record is very telling. And if he has $600 million to spend on this election, it's going to be a powerful weapon in his arsenal. But money cannot break old habits. And if young people sit out this election, if Reagan Democrats sit out this election, if evangelicals sit out this election, these candidates are in trouble. If they cannot drive that base out and those millions of new voters out, they're in trouble. And it says a lot about us as a country as well.
Sherilyn?
That's the question also is, you know, whether or not voters end up, even those who have been excited and energized, end up with election fatigue, because this has been such a long election cycle, longer than we've ever had before, because the Democrats moved their primary election up so early. So, you know, you're asking people essentially a year later to still have that same level of energy to come out. One would hope, I mean, this is a conversation we could only have in America, where we have to actually beg people to come out and vote. But the reality is that, you know, you have to hope, especially for new voters. By new voters, I mean those who are voting for the first time because they're young and they finally reached the age 18, but also new voters because you've had people who've just become so disgusted with the process, many of whom have been energized by the candidacy of Barack Obama, who haven't voted in years and who are coming out to keep that level and to bring out the base at the same time after such a long period of time requires something more than money. It requires a tremendous amount of energy from Barack Obama, who still has to sell himself, still has to become known to the people who don't know him or to the people who are inclined to think they know him but not really know him. So he's got to really be able to keep that energy up. And that's, you know, he is a human being. It's tremendously hard to do, and I think we've seen some of those times when Obama has been tired and not at the top of his game. So I think it's not just the money. I do think the caller is absolutely right, Kevin, that the money is critical and important. You know, it's funny that McCain was the face of campaign finance reform with the McCain-Feingold bill, which the Supreme Court in many ways has kind of interpreted in a way that has worn away the promise of McCain-Feingold. But, you know, almost single-handedly, Barack Obama has created campaign finance reform by the way he's run this campaign, by collecting donations, small donations, from so many people, from millions of people, so that the public is actually, in many ways, financing the Obama campaign in a way that we didn't think about in the past. We thought about public financing, but really financing it with the $10 and the $20 pledges and so forth. And so he's really changed the base of fundraising, which I think is kind of ironic, given that this had been, at one point, McCain's issue.
I still think, in the couple minutes we have left before break here, that one of the issues going to come up in this race is race. We don't know how that's going to play out in the very end here, when people finally go to vote, and that's something I think is going to just be raised over and over again here about who's going to stay away from the polls, who's not going to vote, who's going to switch at the last minute.
It's there every day, Mark. There's no, it's not. It's not something that's going to go away and then come back.
Sherilyn, we'll pick up on this the next Steiner Show with the two of you again. Sherilyn Lifeline from McCarthy, thank you so much for being here.
Great job, Mark. Great to be here.
Great day.
We're going to take a very short break and come right back with the creator of The Wire, David Simon, and hear from Ta-Nehisi and Paul Coates about an interesting new book. So stay with us and don't go away here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, back here on WEAA, the voice of the community. This segment of our show, we're talking with David Simon, who is the creator and producer of The Wire. The Wire is gone, but new things are in store. And David, welcome. Good to have you with me. Good
pleasure
to be here.
Pleasure to be
good
here.
To see you.
Congratulations on being back on the air.
That's great being back on the air. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. We can talk about The Wire, new things going on in David Simon's world and work, and anything you'd like. So 410-319-8888 as we talk with David Simon about many things. So, well, there is life after The Wire.
Tragically so. There's been a lot of travel. We've been shooting in Africa, Ed Burns, myself.
Yeah, let's talk about Generation Kill. The new piece coming up that you shot in Namibia and Mozambique, is that right?
And South Africa.
South Africa.
Three of them together.
Yeah.
It's based on Evan Wright's book about the first weeks of the Iraq War. He was embedded with the 1st Recon Battalion of the U.S. Marines. And it's some of the best war reporting. I mean, I would compare it to Michael Hurst's dispatches. It's that good. We just tried to make his book. I mean, it's strange. We're really the clinicians on this rather than the diagnosticians. We're just trying to cue to the reality that he presented. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun shooting. Shot every roll of film in Baltimore, and then all of a sudden I'm in Mozambique. You know? It's pretty strange.
Which is, I mean, this is it's about the first Gulf War. This is about the Iraq War itself.
This is about this current war.
The invasion of...
This is 2003.
Right. This is going into Baghdad for the first time.
That's right. And all of the subsequent 5 years are really implied in the book. That's the remarkable thing about the book. It is only about the first weeks and the assault on Baghdad. But everything that was going to come to pass, you start seeing from almost the moment they go over the border. And, you know, the lack of a cohesive plan for the occupation... the arrival of the jihadis, the rise of the insurgency, it all starts to make itself apparent.
When I talked to Ed Burns the other day on the phone, just briefly, because we're arranging this interview for you and Ed and the young man who put the book Generation Kill together and the advisor on your movie who did five tours.
Oh, Eric.
Eric.
Eric Cocker, yeah.
Who's also been deeply involved in the film.
Absolutely.
I started wondering how you are. Whenever you do a film, and you and Ed are men who look for reality, and you look for you have a social consciousness and a kind of a political perspective you bring to your work in terms of how you view the world that you're portraying for the rest of the world to watch. And I'm in the middle of Generation Kill, preparing for the interviews next week and reading the book and kind of thinking this thing through. And I wonder, you know, for the guys you're working with who came out of that book and that film, how they view it. I mean, how they view this war.
Actually,
beyond a military film, a shoot-em-up soldier movie.
Right. They're looking at it for, did it reflect their reality? Was it what it was like day to day on their, you know, they went all the way to Baqaba and then back to Baghdad. I mean, you know, they went through some stuff. And so they're looking at... is this the world that I experienced for those 6 weeks? It's very literal for them. And I have to say that is the priority for Ed and myself as well. You know, we have very strong feelings about the war. I think we've probably expressed them somewhere along the line.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is those opinions really don't have any good weight in making this film.
What does that mean? They don't have any good weight in making this film.
This is not about what David Simon thinks about the Iraq War or Ed Burns. It really is about what happened on the way to Baghdad for First Recon, for Bravo Company First Recon. And Listen, a lot went right in the planning for that war. The maneuver warfare the Marines adopted worked exceedingly well. They toppled that government in record time. They outflanked and outmaneuvered a very stagnant army and managed to do it with a minimum of casualties. Other political logic went exceedingly wrong, as we now know. But both things are true, and it's that Fitzgerald line about being able to hold two seemingly opposing ideas in your mind at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Both things have to be given good weight, and you know it can't become a diatribe about what I think about the war. That's not what the book was. That's not what the book is saying. The book is really about young men at war. And the idea of the modern code of the warrior and what that's become in American society. These are 22, 23, 24-year-old men, very inexperienced at life, but intensely trained and intensely experienced at the art of lethal modern warfare. And that's an extraordinary dynamic, and that's what we're really trying to capture. So we were trying to pull that through the keyhole. And so I think to the extent that we've shown the film to real Marines and actually the Marines who are being depicted, because we're using all the real names and everything,
mm-hmm.
They're very grateful that it doesn't feel like it's a political diatribe either way. The Marines are all across the board. Some of them think Iraq was a mistake. Some of them would go back in a heartbeat. Some of them are still there. Some of them are still there with Blackwater. You know, they're not Marines anymore, but they're being paid four times as much as Marines.
Right. Right.
It is what it is. But again, you know, The Wire was we could be as political as we wanted. It was our story, and we could tell it as we saw fit. We felt some fealty to this existing work of journalism that wasn't our own.
David Simon's in our studio right now, of course, creator and producer of The Wire, talking about his new work. You can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we explore this and other things with David Simon, the work that he's engaged in since The Wire has left the air. And we'll take your calls at 410-319-8888. Now, it's always a real trick. I mean, I'm again talking to Ed Burns about this, and when he told me the story about what he did in Vietnam as part of, as far as the Kit Carson scouts being behind the lines with North Vietnamese who had come over and then retrained and how that changed his existence. And it's always a trick when you're dealing with war and stories about war. To tell a real perspective of people who have to live through a battle like that and live through life like that without – and tell the truth about glorification of war. It's a really thin line to walk.
I don't think there are many anti-war movies. I mean, if you think about how many anti-war movies – I mean, there may be movies that even set out to be anti-war. I think Full Metal Jacket is probably an anti-war movie. It's so dry. It's so Kubrick-like that it actually achieves anti-war status. Which is probably not his intent, but it somehow manages it. All Quiet on the Western Front, the original one from the 30s. But short of that, everything ultimately exults in the camaraderie of war. There is nothing that you can take away from the idea of the warrior class and the warrior elite going into battle with each other. I mean, the camaraderie of these Marines is absolutely firm. I mean, I'll tell you one story, which is Eric Cucker. We get over to Africa and the Humvees that we bought in North Carolina. Most of them come off the ship. They're not running. He can't,
right.
And so he calls the guy from the unit he's back at Texas A&M University. He's enrolled in classes. He calls up Jeff Carrizales, who's the guy who made the Humvees run when they were invading Baghdad, and says, "Jeff, I need you again." You know, Jeff was in his platoon, and Jeff's like, "I'm in the middle of classes." He goes, "I need you. I can't get these things running." Like, Jeff's like, he got an emergency passport 24 hours later and is on a flight to Namibia, because Eric called. And that is, it's an old saw, but it's very true. They say in war, you don't fight for your country. You don't fight for your beliefs. You fight for each other.
You fight for the man who's next to you.
Exactly.
Right.
You fight for the guys you're with. And that is – there's nothing more intense than that. And there's no way to take the camaraderie and the charm and the glory out of that. There's no way to honestly do it. You can you know, at the same time, we were not interested in making a war movie that exalted war. You know, these guys are very lethal, and a lot of people get killed in this movie. Not all of them the right people. You know, our modern warfare is a little less pristine than the Pentagon would have you believe, and that's all there in the film. And the lack of precision in the war in Generation Kill is really sort of startling. Even by these soldiers who are trying with goodwill to hit the right thing and to aim at the right thing. But having said that, I don't know what you do with these young men who are going through this extraordinary experience with each other, and they only have each other to rely on. It is what it is. And how did
doing this particular film change you? I mean, you weren't in the service. I mean, you've been through the street stuff with the police reporter, but not
nothing. I've never been close to. I never got to do any war reporting.
So talk about what this did to you. What this film did to you.
Well, it's filmmaking.
But you read the book. You're with men who fought in the war. They advised you in trying to make as realistic a movie as you could about the invasion of Iraq.
I'll tell you what it did. It made me put my own opinions away enough to allow other opinions in, which is, you know, that was not my role on The Wire. The Wire was, you know, I had 13 years of reporting on Baltimore in detail that I was trying to pull through the keyhole and make into something that was relevant to me. It was, you know, there were choices to be made that were my choices. The choices here were really more about listening to Evan, the reporter who was in the back of that Humvee, who did the reporting, and listening to these Marines in terms of the technical aspects and making the stuff as real as possible. I came away with a better understanding for just how well-trained a modern recon Marine. I mean, these guys, you know, there's probably $1.5 million worth of training for each man. I mean, it's really remarkable what, you know, when I was 23, I couldn't, you know, I could barely, you know, clean my bathroom properly. And these guys, are calling in close air support.
Right,
you know, corporals
right.
are calling, you know, they, right. they're trained to work in small units. The technocracy of war is startling. I am not, you know, did it affect my politics on the?
It's not your politics. It's you. I mean, you're sitting with men who've
yeah.
been through this horrendous battle. And the time you do that, I sit with veterans and deal with that. I mean, it changes you. And you're in the everyday, viscerally, intellectually inside of people's heads trying to make a movie about.
Right. And you have to just have to accept that they wanted to go to war because they're 23 years old, 24 years old, and they've been trained to go to war. It's a volunteer army. They are, in some fundamental way, adventurers. They'd like the war to be just. They trust in their government to that it's the right war at the right time. But it's not for them to think, and they don't spend much time thinking on it. I mean, a few do reflectively. And when you get up into the officer corps, there is a little bit more reflection. But if you're a recon Marine and you've trained for war, the last thing you want is peace. I mean, you're not hanging around for peace. So, you know, you had to accept that as the given mindset. But you know, listen, we have a warrior class in this country, and it's by design, and it's by fundamental societal fiat that certain people volunteer for it. You have to give them their stance, you have to give them their place, and you can't you can argue against it on some sort of vague moral ground, but the arguments really don't mean anything, you know, when they're sitting in a tent in Kuwait, waiting to go over the, you know, waiting for the war to start.
David Simon is with us here, 410-319-8888, as we talk about his latest film to start on HBO in July, right?
July 13th.
July 13th. We'll have more about that at the Center for Emerging Media website in the coming weeks. I want to talk about this other thing you're working on before we run out of time, which is aren't you moving to New Orleans to do a series different but similar to The Wire?
I'm not moving.
Not moving, yeah, but I'm saying that. Yeah. Moving your operation to do this.
Well, and actually we'll pick up. I'm not moving the whole operation. That would be unfair to the crews and the unions down in New Orleans. But we are trying to do a show in New Orleans about musicians post-Katrina. Sort of a lighter show. Lighter in the sense of not with a lot of police procedure or anything like that. Just really about a neighborhood, Tremé neighborhood, trying to reconstitute itself after Katrina.
So is this in the works? Are you actually going to start shooting, or
Think we're hoping to shoot the pilot in the fall. You know, the script is in. I got some notes back from HBO. I'm going to take some of them. feign towards some others. And then we'll see what happens. But, yeah, I mean, the signs look good for it.
Put your headphones on. Let's make a very quick call in here. 410-319-8888. And Howard, you're on the air in Gwin Oak.
Yes. How are you guys doing?
Well, Howard.
It's a great show, and good to hear from you, David. What I wanted to know, and I'm sure you get this question all the time, but clear the commercial considerations. Would you consider taking The Wire to a feature film and doing a film on The Wire?
You know, there was a lot of talk about that, and some of the actors actually got financing for it. The trouble is I don't really have a story. And I haven't heard a good story idea from the writers that can stand alone. I mean, nobody's come up with anything. You know, it would either have to be a prequel to the five seasons of The Wire, which we have the problem in terms of the graceful aging, but the aging nonetheless of our cast. Or it would have to come afterwards. And we really resolved it the way we intended to resolve it.
Yeah.
So we're sort of stuck. I'm looking at Sex and the City and thinking there's some box office, but you know, there's never box office for The Wire. We would be deluding ourselves. So,
well, you know, The Wire ended perfectly, I think.
Well, it was where we wanted to go, and I don't know that we have anything more to say. You know, we could have inserted some themes in between, you know, those seasons, well, but not really at the end. Here.
That closing episode was amazing. And David Simon, thanks so much for being here. It's been great to have you back.
Thanks. And, glad to be back with you.
It's great to have you back on the scene here. At this point, we'd like to bring you an excerpt from an interview that's available on our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.com. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a Baltimore native and journalist who released a book called The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. It's about his childhood and experiences growing up as the son of Paul Coates, a Vietnam vet who was also one of the leaders of the Panther Party, who decided to sire his children from succumbing to the life of drugs, crime, and violence in our streets. I sat down with Paul and Ta-Nehisi several years ago and talked with him about the lessons I found in that book. One of the things I said to Paul about your book was, it was the story of a sensitive African-American boy on the west side of Baltimore who had to learn to look tough, act tough, run with a group to survive. And so there were a couple of lessons here. One was the role that home played in your survival, but also what you had to learn how to do to survive on the street yourself, and what it says about the thousands of sensitive young black male children in poor communities without that mm-hmm. being your father.
Mm-hmm. I fear for that. I can't even imagine that. I don't know what would have happened to me. I perish the thought. I'm shuddering even considering it. And I have considered, you know, many times over the, you know, just people look at black boys and, you know, so much of this violence is over respect. And is this sort of instinct that is not completely wrong to say, you guys are completely insane. How are you killing somebody who disrespected you? But these folks have other things, you know what I mean, to build themselves up on. They have other things to base themselves on. You know, I think for so many young brothers, it's that really is all you have. You don't have anything else. What is there between you and an animal? The very least I can make you, you know, talk to me right. The very least I can make it so you will not invade my physical space. You know, I don't have a lot of money. I don't have many prospects for the future. But at the very least, I have that. And without that, I mean, who am I? How do I define myself anymore as any sort of human being? And I think that so much is the source of what goes wrong. Brothers don't have... We just don't have too many ways of defining ourselves, you know? So even though that you know, is sort of, you know, kind of, I guess, what drives me in that fight, I never considered myself that. You know, I knew, you know, I was fairly intelligent. I knew I wasn't going to jail. It was always a line for me. I think the line is, even though there's some scary stuff that happens, I think the line is especially pretty obvious for me. You know, I knew what I wasn't going to do, you know? And that was just as a result of having so many expectations put upon me by my parents, by the larger community, of folks that, you know, my parents put me around. And I think, if anything, we're lacking in that, you know. And I think the country, I think you can look at young people across the country that are lacking in that. But I think in communities which are not particularly wealthy, it becomes so much more crucial to have that. It's a much more important component because you don't have any other way to substitute for that, you know. And I think that's one of the big things with this.
And Paul, for all your inner physical, intellectual strength, and your decision to be a father and stay and take care of these children, and talk a bit about what maybe is not in the book. What about your fears? Mm-hmm. What were you going through watching him and Bill Jr. grow up.
I don't see how, particularly for black men, and for black women too, but especially for black men, I don't see how you can live in a society and not be fearful of a child you bring into the world if that child is a male. I mean, if you look at women, you might not have the same fears, but if you look at the prison population, if you look at the drug population, if you look at who's going into the military, you should be afraid. You should be afraid. And so my great fears, again, was to get the largest fear I had was that these kids would end up in jail. That was the largest fear I had. Yeah. And that's the largest fear. I worry more about that than I do kids on the street killing each other. Now, I know that that's a concern, and so that was always a fear also, but that one goes behind it because there are so many. I think as much as anything, luck may be one of the major factors that keeps kids out of jail.
That was an excerpt from a longer interview with Paul and Ta-Nehisi Coates about the book, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. You can hear the full interview now for streaming and download at our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.com. And I want to remind you all that this weekend, Saturday, there's a very important march taking place on the Juvenile Justice Detention Center from 10 a.m. to noon for juvenile justice reform. You can call 410-547-9200 and go to extension 3007, Ken Strong, to get more information. ACY, Baptist Ministers Group, On Our Shoulders, Reclaiming Our Children with Dante Wilson will all be there. It's a very important rally in March, and we encourage all of you to go there and be part of reforming this system. It needs it desperately, and these people are taking to the streets to demand that. So we're encouraging you all to go out there and join them and fight for what they're doing. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're on WEAA each Wednesday at 9 a.m., and you can listen to our podcast anytime at our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.com. We'd like to thank Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for the use of their studios and office space for Center for Emerging Media. Interns assisting us today here are Judith Lloyd, Stavros Alikas, and Christina Aronson. We're engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman, WEAA's Director of Operations and Production Manager. And I want to say how happy we are to be here at WEAA, to be part of this new family and bringing you great programming once a week during the summer. And this fall, every day, we will be here and can't wait. And I'm Mark Steiner for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.